Welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline Diest, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. Today I'm speaking with Stephen Volk. Hi Stephen, how are you going?
Hi, good to talk to you.
Excellent. A little bit of background about Steve. Steve is a writer of television, film and for the stage. He's best known for the paranormal ITV series Afterlife and the notorious BBC TV Ghostwatch, the Halloween special that spooked the nation. As a fiction writer, he's been shortlisted for a Shirley Jackson Award and the British Fantasy Award. His short story collection, The Parts We Play, and novella, The Little Gift, are out now through PS Publishing. So thank you again for coming on the show, Steve.
Thanks, I'm delighted.
Excellent. So how I'd like to start off is a few warm-ups, so a bit of jogging on the spot, some kind of toe touches, get yourself kind of limbered up. So you write for film, for television, short stories, novellas. What's your favourite medium?
I was thinking that's quite a difficult one, actually, because I think the one that I'm doing is probably, you know, the one that's currently on my desk is probably my favorite thing. And they're so different. I mean, you know, you can get an idea and really write a short story within a couple of days if you're lucky. Longer form takes kind of longer to figure out the longer it gets. So, you know, you can have a quick, sharp experience with a short story. Longer form, especially if you get into scripts. I mean, scripts, because it's massively collaborative, can take months or years or sometimes many years to see many versions of. So it's all stuff, you know, and I think it's basically all storytelling in different ways. And I like to mix it up because the one experience informs the other. And the things you can do in short stories, like, you know, point of view and internal voice and that kind of thing, you have to completely ditch when you're writing scripts. And the things that are really neat in terms of cutting from one thing to another and flashbacks and things like that wouldn't be the same choices you might use when you're doing a novella, for instance. So you can come at things different ways in different forms, and I don't really have a favorite is the short answer.
They're all good. They're all your favorites.
They're all good, yeah.
Okay, so now, do you have any writing rituals?
Not really rituals. I'm kind of surprisingly non-superstitious in terms of, you know, rabbit's foot and all that kind of thing. I do have a desk full of kind of horror genre and fantasy genre toys. You know, I'm looking here at a little minion from the Minions films, a little kind of figurine of Alfred Hitchcock, a kind of skull, a figure of Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, somebody from Breaking Bad, The Big Lebowski, Boris Karloff, some little kind of figures from Hieronymus Bosch paintings. I like to kind of surround myself with pictures and images and things like that that are kind of my friends. I guess that's kind of, I enter this space, you know, my monk cell, a little bit like, you know, you've got to get that kind of focus to get going. But, you know, it's still really hard. After 30 years writing, it's always hard to face the blank page or the blank screen, you know. And I find I'm not a good riser. I'm not an early morning person, and it takes me a while to warm myself up creatively to get into it. And I start with a couple of hours of kind of housekeeping and emails and that kind of thing, and I kind of then warm up to it. And I kind of, my methodology, if anyone's interested, is kind of more or less working into the evening or late. And I find myself, you know, weirdly productive, you know, when at nighttime, if I can force myself to stay up late. And, you know, when everything goes quiet and it's dark and that kind of thing, and you can really focus, it, you know, can be a really productive time of day for me.
So what kind of time are we talking about there? Like 1, 2, later than that?
Yeah, that kind of time. And then, of course, it completely knocks your body clock out because you can't work till 2 or 3 in the morning without completely buggering up the next day. And, so I try and not to do it terribly much now unless the deadlines are really ticking. One kind of tip that I've found is that if I'm on a deadline and I've kind of worked out, you know, what I need to do per day, be it a word count for a novella or something, or, you know, the 10 pages of a screenplay or 5 pages of, you know, I break down my treatment, usually got to do that each day, or half a page of the treatment per day or something like that if I'm going crazy. But what I tend to find is try and kind of, you know, print off those pages and work on them, or work on the next few pages kind of longhand or in a breakdown form. And then kind of do it so that when you come to it the next day, it's going to start with something that you've partly worked out.
Mm.
Don't face the day when you've got a problem hanging over you. Try and solve the problem the day before. And I've always found that's really good advice. You know, try and have something that you want to get your teeth into the next day, as opposed to, you know, doing your best to avoid it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great advice. Excellent. So, last warm-up question. Do you have a writing fuel of choice?
I have a terrible admission that I've just bought one of those George Clooney Nespresso machines. And me and my wife have both rather got into it. We haven't decided which our favorite kind of flavor is yet, but it's really good. It's really good. That's a free plug for Nespresso. But I never really, I mean, the implication of writing fuel maybe is in the alcoholic direction. I find alcohol not really productive. I like it socially, don't get me wrong, when you're with a bunch of mates and everything like that. But when you're dealing with writing, I think it's a bit of a truth killer, in that you can either think something's fantastic and the next day it isn't, or you can think something is really bad and it isn't. So, you know, it's a deceptive kind of demon, really. I personally find that unless I'm feeling really buoyant to begin with, that alcohol can turn into a depressant. So I try and avoid it when mixed with work, really, a lot of the time. I haven't come off coffee, unfortunately.
So you don't subscribe to that Hemingway quote about writing drunk?
No. I don't subscribe to the artist suffering in their garret either. I don't want to suffer at all. All the suffering is in the story, not in my life, hopefully. Or I like it that way.
So you're comfortable with your Nespresso?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, good. So we've got to know you a little bit more, so let's get a little more in depth. So now, how do you describe your writing, and are there themes that you like to explore?
I do like analysing stories, other people's stories, my own stories to a certain extent. And I think when you're trying to work out a story, you are in a way analysing it, even though you might not want to call it that for whatever reason. Some people really fear being pretentious about it if they kind of analyze things. I don't know that I want to analyze myself and my motivation for doing things terribly much. I don't think there's kind of, you know, therapeutic kind of harm in understanding yourself. Like some people think, oh, if I went to a psychiatrist, you know, what would I write about? That's complete bollocks, in my opinion. but on the other hand, I do think that, you know, a friend of mine is a therapist and came and only knows about my work, I think, kind of tangentially, but said over dinner once, and I was quite taken aback, all your stories are about trauma, aren't they? And I thought, well, I haven't thought of that before. So what are my stories about? I think just thinking about the stories I've written over, you know, 20, 30 years, a lot of them are about the clash between belief and rationalism, you know, materialism and spirituality. They're about sometimes fear of the unknown and whether coming to grips with that is going to be beneficial revelation or something that destroys you. People finding something of the past about themselves and whether that's going to work for them or just be the end, you know. I like, you know, internal mental states becoming external. I mean, the obvious example of that is a ghost story, where the psychological state of the person, you could say, projects into the outside world. But I also like fantasies that do that. You know, a fantasy world that's inside someone's head becomes indistinguishable with the reality around them, that kind of thing. And I guess lately I'm also kind of interested in, again, this is kind of an analysis in a way, but, you know, what is it that I've been up to for the last 20, 30 years? I've written about horror and terror and paranormal. What is that all about? What is the business of doing that? And as a way of coming to that, I've written about people that are kind of purveyors of horror in a way. You know, Edgar Allan Poe, for instance, I've written some stories about, and I've written a novella about Peter Cushing, the famous Hammer film actor. And it's a way of actually saying, what is the genre about? Why do we do it? So I'm kind of interested in that in a meta sense as well, if you like.
Because I'm a big fan of the genre as well, and I've been asking that of myself as well. It's like, why am I attracted to this stuff?
Yeah, it's a big question, and I think, you know, you can ask it academically and we could talk about it, but I kind of like using stories to explore it a bit. I mean, my story, Whitstable, which is a novella, which I'll tell you a little bit later on because it's going to be republished, but Peter Cushing in my story comes up against people that say to him, for instance, in one scene, why do you want to star in those horrible films where people do horrible things? And he tries to kind of justify it. And the whole spine of the story really is that horror to some people is a kind of lifeline and is something kind of marvelous and wonderful that protects them. So a thing that other people find repulsive, and why would you want to get into that to, you know, to people that are fans of horror, is something really valuable. So that was one of the subtexts that what was going on in that, really.
Interesting. Okay, so the big question I like to ask is, what is the one thing that you think has been most helpful in improving your writing?
This is the tip that I think it's really important to know, and it was told me when I was doing some tutoring to screenwriters, and we had in William Nicholson, who wrote Gladiator and many other things, and he had a great piece of advice for the young writers that were at the lab that we were doing, and he said this. He said, if you can't write a good scene, write a bad one. Now, that seems very simple, but I know from my own experience, very often you just think, oh, this is rubbish. I'm no good. And you get in that spiral of negativity. I've never been any good. And why am I doing this? But actually, it's just that one thing isn't working out. And you have to actually replenish your confidence and say, you know what? It doesn't matter if it's no good. I'll just get it down on paper. And you know what? I'm good enough to come back to it and realize why it's shit and know how to improve it. You can just do that rather than kind of throw your toys out of the pram and say, I'm no good. It's a very good strategy to just get to the end of the thing and just get that scene down on paper. Say, right, I'm on to the next scene now. I'll come back to that. And almost by the time you've finished it, you've probably figured out by the time you get to the next scene what was wrong with it. So as he said, there's nothing worse than actually staring at something, a blank sheet of paper, and wondering what to do. Just put something down. He said, as soon as you switch on the computer in the morning, just write down three lines. Doesn't matter whether it's gobbledygook. Just do it. And then, you know, that's better than thinking that sentence has to be perfect.
Do you have to remind yourself of this still?
Yeah. I think it becomes kind of an automatic thing that's a bit like a voice in my ear. But I think it's, you know, it doesn't matter how old you get as a writer. It's just you're almost one of those things, you know, that to write and put above the typewriter or the computer every day to remind yourself. You know, I certainly thought it in the last 24 hours where I had a scene that wasn't working, and I thought, you know, this is all I'm writing a novella, and I thought it was all dialogue. There was no sense of liveliness about the scene. I had to put some description into it, and I thought, hang on, don't beat yourself up over it. You've just said what's wrong with it, so just, you know, cool down, don't rush, go back to it. And so I think I've improved it somewhat.
Good. Are you trying anything new at the moment?
I am. I was trying to think how to answer this one. Something a bit that was quite a kind of a complex problem. I'm writing a novella about not one but two real life people, although they're in a fictional situation. Now, I had to do some research, obviously, about those people in order to get some backbone of realism about how I was going to describe them and have them react to things, as I did with Peter Cushing in the novella that I just talked about, Whitstable. So a similar kind of project. And what I found was I did an awful lot of research, and it was kind of getting ungainly. I had kind of 300, 400 pages of just notes about what these people did and the biography and just little snippets of things that I thought were usable and interesting. And I thought, how am I going to actually filter this or, siphon this into a fictional story and not feel as if I'm really, you know, using the research just to kind of show off. So what I did was I went through an interim stage of writing quite a big document as a breakdown of how I was going to write it as a piece of fiction. But what I did was in each scene or each chapter, if you like, I kind of organized my research so that I got a first draft of where I thought the pieces of research would possibly be used. Oh, yes, he would be thinking, he might be thinking back to that in that scene, or he, you know, that little bit of description would of that person, what they looked like would suit that scene. Or even things about, you know, what someone, how someone dressed, or what they drank, or ate, you know, or where they were, you know. So I thought, I've got to go through this interim stage of just sifting that material and getting it in some kind of order, which took a long time, but I was really pleased with it as a piece of methodology, because it meant that when I got to the actual writing, I kind of felt as though I almost had a first draft in front of me. And it was a case of, tidying up and improving it, which is what I'm in the thick of doing now. But it was, I said halfway through, this seems absolutely crazy way to go about it. But I literally couldn't think of any other way of doing it, because I didn't want to start writing and then find, oh, I don't know what goes there, or I don't know what to do next, or find a bit of information in, you know, the two or three dozen books I've got sitting on the floor here. I didn't want to be in that position of having to find stuff. So I thought, no, try and get it down. I probably won't use half of it or even three quarters of it. But if I've got it all sorted out in sections, then at least I know where to find it. And that proved to be useful. That was a very long answer, I'm afraid, but that's all I could think of.
So had you broken it down to the pieces of true facts that you wanted to use, as I think you said, chapter by chapter? So did you outline the story itself and then almost next to it, oh, this is where the facts would go? Is that how it worked?
Yeah. Well, it was more cross-pollination than that, really, because I figured out the story as I was doing the research. So I had a kind of treatment outline that was very fluid and changing as the more I was finding out. Mm-hmm. And the stuff I was finding out about the characters informed, the way the story was built up, really, and the story structure. For instance, I'd discover things in the backstory, in the actual story of the people that were quite revelatory, you know, things about family or the past or certain crucial moments, you know. And I thought, oh, that fits absolutely well into what I want to achieve in this story. And that, frankly, is the absolute joy of doing something based on factual information. I mean, I'm not sure I'd want to write a historical novel that purports to be true, like historical novels kind of do some of the time. But, I mean, there's no pretense in this that it's something that happened. It's not something that happened, but but I nevertheless want the characters and how the characters behave to be plausible, and I find that a kind of really exciting combination for me personally.
Good.
I'm being evasive about who the characters are. It'd be a hell of a lot easier if I told you who they were, but I kind of want to keep that under wraps right now. I'm really sorry to be really secretive about that. It's kind of like, because I'm in the middle of it, I don't want people to start to say, oh, you're doing that. You know, once it's kind of done, I'm happy, more than happy for everyone to know. But, I'm sure you have that feeling as well, which is people underestimate the fun of writing being partly about secrecy. You know, you've got something going around in your head and it's deliciously intoxicating because nobody else knows what it is. It's a whole world that's inside you, and you almost don't want to share it until it's ready, you know.
There's kind of two schools of thought of that I've heard of, is that some people are like, yeah, don't jinx it by telling anyone. And then there's other people who are maybe a little bit more kind of business-minded or whatever, who are just like, well, you've got to, like, test it with people.
Well, I think both are true. Both are absolutely true. I think there is a feeling, I don't want to jinx it. I don't want to be the guy that says to my neighbour, oh, I'm writing a book about bat, and they look completely blank, or I've never heard of that person, or who's that, or and their fractional look of disinterest could knock you back for days, you know, or just plague you sometime. And you think, am I doing the right thing, am I not doing the right thing? It's better not to idly tell people. On the other hand, I do test things on people. I mean, I've got lined up half a dozen people that I want to read this thing. So I'm not going to put it out in the world until I've tested it on some people and thoroughly listened to their opinion of it. But there's a right time to do that. There's a time to keep it to yourself, and there's a time to share, really, I think, just on a practical level, I think.
Yeah, good. So you mentioned Edgar Allan Poe, you met before. What writers inspire you?
Quite a range of writers, really. On the publishing side, one of my favourite writers is a guy called Patrick McGrath, who wrote an excellent, wonderful book of short stories called Blood and Water, which I think was instrumental in being coined as the start of the new Gothic kind of strain of literary fiction. I think in the 90s, I think, and that encompasses Joyce Carol Oates and people like that, people that hark back to and love traditional Gothic literature, but somehow bring something modern and interesting and post-Freudian to it. So I love his work, and I'm reading his new book, which is called The Wardrobe Mistress at the moment. I love the novels of Stephen Gallagher. He's a friend of mine, but he won't mind me saying that. Well, I can't imagine he would mind me saying that. I mean, he just seems to write, and he'd laugh at this so kind of effortlessly, and is just an absolute born storyteller, you know? And the simplicity with which he writes, not a single sentence is there to show off his knowledge of anything. It's just there, placed absolutely right, and I really genuinely enjoy his writing. There are a few writers in the film world that I'm enjoying at the moment that I'll mention, if I may.
Go for it.
I really love a film called Wind River, and the writer-director of that was a guy called Taylor Sheridan, who I think is brilliant. There's a horror film, quite a small horror film that I found very effective, called A Dark Song, and that was written and directed by Liam Gavin. And there's a very supremely weird and strange film called Killing of a Sacred Deer. I don't know if you've seen it. And that was written and directed, or certainly directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. And I think written with him and somebody else. But I also like, at the moment, I'm really enjoying a TV show called The Leftovers. And that's created and a lot of it written by Damon Lindelof and Tom Perrotta, I think, also wrote the book on which it's based. So those are some current people that I'm enjoying, to be honest with you. But, you know, my likes are very wide, I like to think.
Good. Okay, so you were talking a little bit before about your current book, Whitstable.
Well, that's from a while back, actually. Okay. The book that's just come, my most recent book is The Little Gift, yeah, which was a novella, quite a small novella, again from PS Publishing. And the what inspired that in a way was wanting to come at a crime story in a sense in a very different way. I do tire a little bit that a crime story always has to be about something to solve, and it always has to be about a detective or a cop, and it's a kind of mystery. And I'm kind of more interested in, I guess, the repercussions of crime and what makes someone a criminal. I guess I kind of always liked Barbara Vine books more than the Ruth Rendell books, which were about Inspector Wexford. You know, I kind of liked her books about criminality. So I guess The Little Gift was more a story coming at the impact of crime and that genre in a slightly different way. But what I'm working on, just to come to what I'm working on now, to be honest, is the last part of a trilogy which started with Whitstable, just to come back to that. And it's called the Dark Masters Trilogy. And it'll be published later this year by PS, my publisher. And it'll comprise two novels I've written already, Whitstable and Leytonstone. Whitstable, as I said, was from the point of view of Peter Cushing, the horror writer. Leytonstone, the second novella in the series, was about Alfred Hitchcock growing up in London as a little boy. And the third one is about somebody, again, related to the horror genre, but who I'm afraid, going to reveal to you quite yet. But the three of them are completely separate stories, but they're kind of linked together thematically about the genre and about the conflict in a way between fiction and real life for people that are working in the kind of territory that me and people like me are working in.
Sounds really fascinating.
Well, that should come out, I hope, in September. So hopefully that'll be on time if I can crack on.
How close to the end are you now? What stage are you at?
Well, I think I'm due to deliver probably at the end of the month. That's what I'm aiming for. I've got kind of set sections that I need to do by the end of the week and that kind of thing. So I think I'm on track. Who knows?
Is that a self-directed deadline, or is in terms of how much you need to do?
I kind of want to get it done because it's taken me so much time so far, to be honest, and I start to beat myself up, and it's the usual kind of self-punishment. I think I need to just crack on and get it done, and then open the window for other possibilities. What I don't want is to be halfway through it and then I get a phone call to work on another project, or something distracts me, and then I've kind of got to get my, you lose impetus on that, really. With a kind of long form piece of work, you really need to keep that focus. It's okay taking a day off or something like that, but if you have to take a couple of weeks off, then it takes a long time to get back in the saddle, really. So I'd rather keep at it and get it done.
Okay, well, that sounds like a cue to let you go so that you can crack on with it. Yeah. So if people are interested in finding out more about you and your work, where's the best place to find you online?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Steve Volk Writer, STEVEVOLK Writer, all one word. Or my website is stephenvolk.net, Stephen with a PH. StephenVolk.net, and I'm on Facebook sometimes. I come off it and then go back on it. So I might be there, I might not.
Good. Well, thank you so much for spending the time today. It was really interesting to hear about your process.
Oh, great. It's been good to chat. Been really good. Good luck with your writing too.
Oh, thank you.
And everyone that's listening, of course. We all need to do well. So we all need to support each other. So that's always the way I look at it.
Oh, fabulous. Thanks, Steve.
All right, great. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Now, I'm struggling with my own writing at the moment. I'm doing a first draft of a new manuscript with all new characters and a new genre. Firstly, I realise I am beating myself up a bit because it's not flowing the way I feel it should. I need to have a good talking to myself about not having such high expectations. But that's another story. Anyway, I've hit the mushy middle. That's the point where I'm past the excitement of the beginning of the journey. I've hit all the beats of the beginning. Now I'm into the wasteland between the beginning and the midpoint crisis. Now I know the very end, and I know where I want to be, but I don't quite know how I'm going to get there. It's like hiking up a mountain with no paths, or working my way through a maze. And just like I do with my characters, my progressive complication is that this is my first real foray into a mystery novel where my protagonist is solving a crime. So, you know, extra added pressure to get all the clues, the lies, the red herrings and everything along the way. And I'm worrying that I haven't done enough planning. Now, this is also where I usually get stuck, and I have to remind myself of that. When I was first starting to write, this is the point where my NaNoWriMo attempts would often fail. So think of this tip this week as a bit of talk therapy for me, as I remind myself how I usually go about fixing this, because it's not the first time, and it won't be the last. So some ways that I've solved this before include jumping ahead. So I know the midpoint crisis and the all is lost moment and the ending. So in previous stories, I've just jumped to the end and written those sections to inform me about how do I get there. Who says you have to write in sequence? Another thing that I'll do is play and experiment. Not everything needs to go in the final manuscript. No one needs to know they've written the same scene 14 times in 15 different ways just to find the right approach. You know, add an octopus, add a fight scene, add a stupid joke, make it ultra melodramatic, and the answer will eventually come. A third approach is to spend some more time chewing over the plan. Now, I know my characters better at this point, so let's look at the plan again and see if it still works or if the characters are telling me of new ways to push forward. Has my writing so far covered other elements of the character and their emotional journey which inform the next steps? So take a little time out and don't force the next scene, just reset my coordinates. And in researching for today's section, I picked up a nice new tip, which I'm going to try, which is starting by writing the killer end of the scene, like a snappy final sentence to give you the end point. And I imagine this will be especially helpful when writing a mystery because I'm adding the intrigue and the clues to keep the suspense and the narrative traction. So while I apologise for the bunch of mixed metaphors about journeys and pathways, etc., and how this discussion has been part therapy for me to talk out what I need to do, I hope you found something useful here if you're also suffering from the doldrums of the mushy middle. Thanks for listening to Write Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter, no apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Write Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?